Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. I am your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Welcome to Bits About Books. Our guest today is Graham Shaw, and we speak with him about his bestseller, The Speaker's Coach, 60 Secrets to Make Your Talk, Speech, or Presentation Amazing.
And in my years, starting off being a teacher in primary schools with children aged up to 12, subsequently working at British Airways as a training manager, and then subsequently, since 1995, being involved in freelance in coaching speakers and teaching these skills. Over the years, I realized that I had picked up so many techniques and tips from other people and things I'd noticed myself that I just thought, I wish I'd known this earlier. So I thought, could I put everything into a book with lots of simple tips that would shortcut for people? That was the idea.
Graham is speaker, coach, and international conference presenter. He has helped thousands of people make convincing presentations. His specialty is visual communication, and he's best known for his ability to convey business ideas with a quick sketch. His numerous conference audiences have been amazed to discover that they too can draw their ideas, a talent they never knew they had. Graham has appeared on BBC television and radio, including BBC World News, Talking Business, and BBC World Service Radio, as well as in numerous business and lifestyle publications. He spoke at TEDx Hull in 2015, and his talk, Why People Believe They Can't Draw and How to Prove They Can, has been viewed by over 40 million people. It is one of the most viewed talks in the TED online library of talks. More recently, he spoke at TEDx Vienna on the topic, How to Draw to Remember More. He is a speaker coach to TEDx speakers. Graham is author of the popular book, The Art of Business Communication, which was shortlisted for the UK's Chartered Management Institute Management Book of the Year Awards 2016. His latest book, the one we speak about today, The Speaker's Coach, 60 Secrets to Make Your Talk, Speech or Presentation Amazing, was shortlisted for the Business Book Awards 2020. The book was also named by CEO Magazine in the 10 Most Inspirational Business Books for 2020. As a former manager in corporate training at British Airways, he was involved in the delivery of leadership and management development training. He has helped numerous organizations in over 20 years of consulting, including BP, Boston University, BSkyB, British Airways, British Gas, Google, Henley Business School, HSBC Bank, London Business Forum, Oracle, PwC, Samsung, The Samaritans, Siemens, Space Savers, Tesco, and the World Health Organization. Now, on to this insightful episode with Graham Shaw. Graham, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm, more than delighted to have you because you are a celebrity, right? And what you do fascinates me in terms of the doodling and the speaking and what you have been putting out in the world. I'm so happy that I'm able to have you here and to talk to you about it.
Thank you very much, Subhanjan. And I don't know about the celebrity, but yes, I have enjoyed doodling, and I thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
Yes, and this book is special because being a speaker is something all of us think we are naturally able to do it. I mean, I'm not talking about those who don't want to talk outside, but essentially speaking is a part of curriculum. We do public speaking, we do debates. So a lot of that is already there in the air. Yet, if somebody is going through your book, most of us possibly is doing it pretty badly. So my question is, first, you wrote a book on communication before. And
yes,
then you wrote this book. What made you write this book?
Well, the first book was about how we communicate ideas with a drawing, the art of business communication, all about the sketching skills. This book is all about how we can plan a talk and give a presentation. And over my life, I've done plenty of that. And my teaching work was all about not only the drawing skills, but then most of the time I was simply coaching speakers or running presentation skills courses. And in my years, starting off being a teacher in primary schools with children aged up to 12, subsequently working at British Airways as a training manager, and then subsequently, since 1995, being involved in freelance in coaching speakers and teaching these skills. Over the years, I realized that I had picked up so many techniques and tips from other people and things I'd noticed myself that I just thought, I wish I'd known this earlier. So I thought, could I put everything into a book with lots of simple tips that would shortcut for people? That was the idea.
When exactly, in terms of timeline, when exactly do you think that, okay, this is time to put all this wisdom that I've gathered into a book, which will be beneficial for those who want to speak publicly? And what did you do after that?
Well, yes, it was in about 2014-15, I think it was, when my publisher, we were actually sitting in the British Library at a book award, and the first book, The Art of Business Communication, I was fortunate enough that it was shortlisted as a finalist. And I was sitting next to my commissioning editor, and it was a finalist of six books, but it didn't win, actually. And she turned, but that was still good. And she turned to me and said, well, you better write another one now. But I didn't immediately, but I always had it in my mind after that first book that I would write one about speaking skills. And so I then wrote to her in probably about 2017, I think it was, 18. And said, I've got an idea, another idea for a book. And prior to writing to her, I wrote down a lot of things that I thought could be in the book. And Eloise Cook, her name is, of Pearson Publishing, and had a meeting with her to see if it was viable. So really, it was the kind of thing I thought, if I don't write it, I'll regret it.
Of course. So did this happen while you were already doing your talks or the public talks, or was this sort of before that?
No. This was after I'd been doing public talks for a long time. Yes. Right. So right. I've been doing public talks since about 1995. Quite a long time afterwards. Yeah.
So by this time, obviously, you have encountered a lot of people. You have trained a lot of people. You have actually seen what's working, what people are stumbling on, what people are sort of. So that thought process. So were you actually taking down notes of these ideas as you were sort of going through your process of coaching people and making your public appearances?
I often would make notes, but I wasn't particularly making notes for a book.
Right.
I would be just adding to my expertise, really, making notes of things that I could include in future training, because I would be teaching people to speak as well as speaking myself. So I was constantly building up my knowledge and seeing how other people did it. It was only then when I sat down in sort of 2017-18 and I wrote down all the different things that I could remember that I thought would be helpful to pass on. Yeah.
When you started, did you start with 60 tips or 60 secrets, or was it a number that came up later?
No, it was a number that came up later. I started really with just writing down all the different tips that I could come up with, and it was probably 130 or 40 tips, but of course some of them are subsets of others, you know. Right. So they were random, really. And then I basically didn't whittle them down to 60, but I just went to see the commissioning editor and we discussed whether we'd got enough for a book, and then decided that 60 was a good number. Yeah, and then it was a question of when we thought, yeah, okay, 60 is a good number. And of course, it's not just 60 secrets, because some of them have got several tips within one tip. But so it's a lot more, really. But then it was a question of organizing this information. And right. one of the things that I decided was to try and do it more or less in sequence, chronologically. So that's why in the book is in three parts. So I have part one, which is all about planning your presentation. We call preparing. Part two is about practicing. So, okay, practicing, rehearsing. And part three is called performing. So perhaps to have three P's, but more or less that's chronological, is preparing, practicing and performing. So then I organize the tips more or less into those categories.
How long did it take you to sort of start to finish? How long did it take you to complete the book?
It was about 8 months. Yeah.
Okay.
So, but I was doing work at the time, so I'm not sitting every day writing the book. So I was still doing freelance work at the time. Yeah. And the book before took about the same time as well.
So is it something like you do in the weekends, or did you have some kind of a routine as to when you will go to the book and actually work on it?
Yes. I interestingly, I looked up what other authors do. I did some research on Google about often famous authors, you know, like Charles Dickens and people like that. And what I discovered was that it's important to have big chunks of time. Yeah. And to really concentrate. You may have come across Cal Newport and his book, Deep Work.
Yes.
And Cal Newport, who is from MIT, I think, he talks about having big chunks of time. And there's my prime time for thinking. I discovered when I researched other authors that mostly they worked in the morning when their brains were alert. That doesn't work for everybody because some people are more night owls, you know. Mm. But I decided to do that. And most of them got a routine. So, for example, Charles Dickens, he wrote in the morning. And then in the afternoon, he might go for a walk or something. He still was thinking about the characters, but he didn't have the hard discipline of writing. So he would be imagining how certain scenes would work, but he didn't actually have to write it all down. So I would tend to do more in the mornings. I might get fed up of being at home and go out to a cafe and do something in the afternoon where not real serious writing, but I might be working out the next chapter, creative things like that.
Right.
So I found that the one lesson I learned from it all was it's important to find what time works for you. I had a routine. I didn't do it every day because I couldn't always do it every day. But I tended to do it in the mornings. And but it, apart from having big chunks of time, you have to be also ready to use small bits of time. So say I was in an airport or waiting for something, I might have for an appointment, I might have a notebook, you know. And I, even if I'd only got 30 minutes, I would start to work out something, or I might be on a train journey.
So
grabbing the small bits of time, but having the really big bits of time for the focused work. Yeah.
Before we move on to the book, the last question on this in this series is about your doodles.
Yes.
When did you start that? I mean, you have been a trainer, you have been a teacher. I didn't ask, what were you teaching?
Well, I taught in England, what we call primary schools.
Right.
So these were children aged from 5 to 11 or 5 to 12. So I was what's called a general subjects teacher. So I would have a class of 10 and 11-year-olds, yeah, and teach them most things, yeah.
Okay. So what I was trying to figure out was where you were art teacher specifically, which you are not. So you are a general teacher, general subject teacher. So how did this doodling come about? I mean, when did you start doing it? How did you... They're very good.
Well, I started when I was a little boy, you know, when I was 4 or 5, drawing on everything at home, drawing on the eggs in the fridge, drawing little faces on the eggs, drawing on the oranges with a ballpoint pen, and copying cartoons from comics. But I did actually study art at college when I was a teacher, and I qualified as a with art as my main subject. So I could have taught art in for older children if I'd wanted to, but I specialized in the younger children. So I'd always been able to draw cartoons. And then when I was at school teaching, I would sometimes tell a story in assembly where all the children were in the morning, but I would draw a picture sometimes to go with it. So on an acetate, the overhead projector, some of your listeners might remember, and it would appear on the screen behind, and the children could follow the story. And I even met one of the pupils recently, who's a policeman now, who reminded me about 2 weeks ago that he was at my school and used to watch me do it. And then when I moved to British Airways and I was a trainer, when we got the flip chart, sometimes if I had a business model to explain, I may draw it. So I found I could make a picture of it sometimes. And so that got me into it. So then I more started to realize that I could use it to communicate ideas in training. And that's how it all started, really.
It's wonderful, actually. They add so much value to the book and makes it so much more accessible, I think.
Yeah, well, I gave myself double the amount of work, because when I said to I saw another book that was called something like 101 Business Models That Will Change the Way You Work, I think it was called. And that had, for every tip, 100 tip, it had a drawing. And I thought, I could do that. Except it doubled the work, because then I was the illustrator. For every tip, there's one illustration or more, you know.
Absolutely. It's very interesting that my previous guest on the podcast, which I recorded, was with a gentleman called Charles Burney. And he runs a podcasting production company out of Washington. And he wrote a book called The Tao of Podcasting. And he's a doodler like you. And he actually illustrated that, and it's quite uncanny that I have two guests back to back who are not quote unquote trained artists. I mean, you are. I mean, you did have a subject, but he's not, and this is quite interesting for me.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating thing.
Absolutely. So let's move on to the book itself. Let's pick up a few of the topics that you have, few of the secrets that you talk about. Let's take up number two, which talks about help the audience and they will help you.
Yeah, well, the basic idea of that is that quite often people may treat the audience as not quite enemies, you know, but they think that... they've got to, they're competing with the audience, you know. And I often say, if you really connect with the audience and you really look after their interests and you start from where they are, not from where you are, and you make them the stars of it, then you're going to have a better chance. Don't hold anything back from them. You know, don't try and be clever. You know, try and give them everything genuinely you've got. And one of the best tips I've had is to put yourself in their shoes and think, what would they be thinking? What would their concerns be? And you may or may not know that entirely, but you can often second guess quite a lot. And there's a wonderful quote that I put in the book from a gentleman called Ken Hamer, who worked at AT&T on presentations. And I'll paraphrase it probably slightly, but Ken Hamer said, to plan a presentation without the audience in mind is like trying to write a love letter that begins "to whom it may concern." Yeah. You know, so you could write a love letter starting "to whom it may concern," but it wouldn't be a very good one. So looking after the audience is really trying to put yourself in their shoes, gaining rapport with them.
So one quick side question on this. When we're doing one-to-one, it's possibly easy to, not easy, but comparatively easy to guess and assess and fine-tune one's presentation. But when you're talking of an audience of hundreds, how do you do that? Because you're some level, you are homogenizing them and you're sort of thinking of them as a block, which it is not.
Yeah. One of the big tips I would give in terms of planning is that, and this isn't my model. There's a particular model, an approach known as the format system. Number four, MAT system, format system, which was devised by a lady called Bernice McCarthy originally for teaching. And it's a wonderful system, but it's very simple. And it's many people would say, well, that sounds obvious when I tell you what it is. But most speakers don't do all of it, in my experience. And basically, how it works is there are really about four key questions that will be on any audience's minds. So if you've got a mixed audience, you might know a little bit about them, you might not. Some people, when they listen to you, their main question on their mind will be why. Why have I got to listen to this? And if you don't engage them and help them to be interested at the beginning, that they won't listen. Other people, their main question on their mind is what, which is the what questions. They want lots of information. So these people are more academic often. They want the main concept, the main idea. Mm. Other people, the main question on their mind is how. How will it work for me? You know, how does it work in practice? They want examples. They want to have a go, that sort of thing. Other people, their main question on their mind is, what if? And there are two sorts of what if question. One, what if it doesn't work? What if it goes wrong? What if, the problems. And the second what if question is, what if it does work? These are people who are already thinking out to the future about, you know, if I could use what you're telling me, what benefits would there be? So you've got four questions. Why would they be interested? Why am I talking about this? What is the big idea? How does it work in practice? What are the potential problems and how would you overcome them? And where can you apply this in the future? Now, if you cover all of those questions, you will cover all the main questions that are on everybody's mind in the audience, because it's an exaggeration to say that people are only interested in one question. So the why people are also a little bit interested in the how, or the what people also are a little bit interested in the why. But it's just that people have preferences. That structure will cover a lot of bases and ensure that you appeal to many different people. So that's one big way of achieving that.
Absolutely. This is fascinating. Although I have questions when I'm thinking of certain topics, whether you can literally do this or not, and how do you adapt this into that format for topics which don't necessarily lend themselves to this structure straight away?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing I'd say is I've yet to come across a topic in which I couldn't use the structure. That's the first thing I'd say. But it may be that my tip would be to, in your planning, rather than planning slides straight away, get some post-it notes out or bits of paper, think about your topic, perhaps put the headings, why, what, how, what if, and begin to organize your thoughts. Because the majority of people will find a lot of information easily for the what and the how, because that's the main body of the talk. But when you come to the why, think about the audience and why those particular people might be interested, and come up with some reasons for them. And if you think hard enough about your audience, you will, in fact, be able to complete all of those sections. It may be easier sometimes than others, but nevertheless, in my experience, you will be able to do that. Interestingly enough, I heard Michael Johnson, the athlete, talking in the Olympics, and he wasn't talking about the format system, but somebody asked him about communication in coaching. And he said, when the coach used to come to me to run a great training session, first he would tell me what we were going to do. That was a little what. But then he'd explain why we're doing it. Okay. So why are we going to do this practice? Then he'd, before we started, he'd explain how is the practice going to work? this particular training session. And then he would explain to me what would be the benefit if I did it. Okay. So in all of that, he's got a bit of why, a bit of what, a bit of how, and a bit of what if in a Michael Johnson training session. So it doesn't always have to be exactly in that sequence. You can be flexible with it. But I thought, Michael Johnson has got many elements there of that system.
Absolutely. That's a fascinating anecdote.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
That's interesting. I think personally, from experience, I think most people try and prepare as best they can. My tip, though, is when you've got some structures like this, you can prepare much more quickly. The other thing is, in terms of preparation, in my experience, it's not practical to prepare in great detail for every presentation you do. If you're doing the morning briefing at work or you're doing something every week, you can't sit for hours preparing everything.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for Bits About Books and founder of PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode where we left it.
So that actually brings me to the next point that I wanted to touch upon from the chapter of why it's a bad idea to wing it. And I think I have a sense of why they do it. And please do explain after I finish. So my thing is that people might think it's too much of work. I know what I want to talk about. Let me just talk about it and not worry about this structure, which will actually engage my audience.
Yes. Well, when I say it's generally a bad idea to wing it, it generally is. Although to be fair, sometimes you might not have much time to prepare. In which case, that's where a structure that you've got in mind is already helpful. Right. So, for example, it looks like you're winging it, but if you've got good structures in your mind, I'll give you an example. Let's say you're in a meeting, Shubhanthan, and somebody says, oh, Shubhanthan, can you update us on this project? And you're thinking, oh, my goodness, what am I going to say first? If you think about this system, you can think, okay, let me first tell you in one line what the project is about. Then let me tell you why we're doing it. Okay, what are the reasons behind it? What was the problem that caused us to do this project? Now let me tell you what is the big idea of this project? What are we trying to achieve? So now we're in the what. Now let me give you some examples of how we've been doing it. Now let me tell you in the what if some problems we've had and how we've overcome them. Now let me tell you what we're going to be doing next month and the next month after that and in the coming year going forward. So you sound very eloquent, but actually you've got a structure in your mind. So it can help you to wing it if you have some structures in your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is definitely extremely, extremely insightful. So my question still is, do you think people... Okay, my question is, do you think more people wing it than prepare in this format?
That's interesting. I think personally, from experience, I think most people try and prepare as best they can. My tip, though, is when you've got some structures like this, you can prepare much more quickly. The other thing is, in terms of preparation, in my experience, it's not practical to prepare in great detail for every presentation you do. If you're doing the morning briefing at work or you're doing something every week, you can't sit for hours preparing everything. So there are what I call low stakes and high stakes presentations or talks. Yes. So, for example, you're talking to your weekly meeting. They won't mind if you make a mistake. You know, they won't mind if you say, oh, I forgot this. Let me just check my notes for a moment. You know, that's fine.
Yeah.
But if you're speaking at a very important conference, you want to make sure that you have it much more thoroughly prepared. So I think there are different levels of preparation as appropriate for the situation.
Right. I would like to go to the next chapter, and I would like to ask you about the Aristotle's three pillars of persuasion.
Yeah.
And how did you sort of get it into your thought process, and then what they are?
Yeah. Well, it's something that I just found, that I discovered. I heard someone else mention it, but interestingly, it built on what I already knew, which was that the facts are not sufficient to convince people usually. So we think we convince people by facts, but we also need the heart convincing. So not just the head, but the heart convincing. So an example, a pharmaceutical company that I've worked with a lot in the past created something that really helped to cure an eyesight problem. Okay, so when I was helping them to prepare for a conference, I noticed that one of the speakers who came to me for coaching was talking about this. And I believe they had, he'd got all the information to explain. But I believe when they did the conference, they had somebody in, whether it was the mother or the father, or they told the story about a child who'd been cured. I'm not sure whether they got the mother or father in, but they told the story of a child who'd been cured by this. So you've got the appeal to the head with all the scientific information, the appeal to the heart with the story of the little boy. So that's kind of how that works with the, and we call that logos. Aristotle called it logos, or logic, if you like, appealing to the head by using reasoned argument and evidence. Pathos, appealing to the heart. So this is where you might tell a story. This is why stories are so powerful. So as well as having hard evidence and statistics, stories are very good. And then the ethos, the other pillar, the ethos is what conveys your expertise when you speak. So, for example, in ethos, what might convey your expertise is when you're introduced at the beginning of a talk. What are your qualifications, or why? What projects have you done relevant to this topic? But also, your ethos is enhanced when you use credible sources. So when you show evidence. So yes, ethos, logos, and pathos. But basically, you know, where's your credibility coming from? Appeal to the head, appeal to the heart.
Right. That's fascinating that Aristotle thought about this, I don't know, like several hundred years ago.
Yeah.
Let's touch upon a bit about the title. You say that finding the right title is critical.
Yes.
For the presentation.
Yes.
It is just not a headline.
I mean, it's trying to find a title that would motivate people to speak. I mean, Melina, for one of your interviews that I listened to,
yes,
had a great title, yeah, which was, what was it? What your customers, what was that one?
What your customers want.
Yeah, but won't tell you or can't tell you or something,
yeah,
wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was already intrigued by that title. So really, it's about getting a title that will get people curious, will hook people in. So for example, how titles are very good. So something like, I noticed in some of the TED Talks, we've got a title called How to Design a Library That Makes Kids Want to Read. Okay. Yeah. There's a TED Talk by Anyan Chatterjee called How Your Brain Decides What is Beautiful. Okay, so what happens in your brain when you pay attention? So titles that are a question are great. So anything that hooks people in. So rather than something like health and safety update,
right?
You might have something like, you know, why we need to take action now on health and safety or whatever it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that sort of dovetails into the chapter you wrote about how to grab the attention in the first 30 seconds.
Really, it's about trying to get people on board and saying some things that people will be nodding and saying yes to. Okay. So the big thing that I think is a problem for people quite often is saying something that doesn't make complete sense to the group at the beginning. Okay. Right. So that's why sometimes it's a bit dangerous to begin with a joke or something like that. If we do that, we've got to be very certain that it's going to work. Okay. But grabbing attention in the first 30 seconds, if people are interested right at the start, then you've got them on board. So Simon Sinek, for example, is very good at that. He starts his TED talk by saying something like, why is it that things don't always go as we assume? Why is it that things don't, why is it that some companies are more innovative than others with the same sort of people, you know? Why is Apple so innovative? So there are three rhetorical questions at the beginning. So that grabs attention. David Epstein in his TED talk on athletic performance started with a fantastic statistic. He said something like, in the 2012 marathon, Olympic marathon in London, the winner ran a time of something like 2 hours and 8 minutes or something. I can't remember what it was. He said, had he been running against the winner of the 2004 Berlin marathon, Olympic marathon, he would have won by almost an hour and a half. Okay. So, it's saying something that would grab attention at the beginning is a good thing.
Yeah. And it sort of fits into the format system as well. So these are all sort of multiple secrets working together to make it a memorable speech or presentation.
Yes, they do work together, Shubha and Jan, because it's not just about telling people why. You could be asking, get them thinking in their minds. The other key thing I would say at the beginning, it's very useful if you can say a few things at the beginning that the audience in their mind will be saying yes to. Because if the very first thing you say, the audience are thinking, well, I'm not sure about that. And the second thing you say, they think, well, that doesn't sound that great either. What are they thinking about the third thing that you might say, that even if you haven't said it yet? So, whereas if you say, have you ever had a time where you worked really hard, but you still couldn't find the answer, you know? And have you had a time where you weren't even thinking about the problem and suddenly it came into your head? Oh, yeah, we've all had that. Yeah. Well, would you like to help? How about if you could make that happen more often? Wouldn't that be great? If you could more often have these creative ideas. So today what we're going to do is look at creativity and how we can be even more creative.
Yeah. That's really great.
So that's the link from the why into the what. Why am I talking about it into the what we're going to do today?
So actually literally thinking about getting the audience through what you are trying to, whatever journey you have in mind, that they will sort of be with you for over that one hour or whatever you're speaking. It is in many ways reminds me of how you make a film or how you write a piece of theater.
Yes.
Right. So it's literally that. It's like imagining that this is the journey I'm going to take them along and actually ensure that all the elements of that is available.
Absolutely. And I would suggest that a great way of planning a talk or presentation is to have it like a storyboard. One of the people that I was coaching in Italy in this particular pharmaceutical company with all bits of paper, he said to me, come into my office and have a look, see how I'm getting on with my conference talk. And his wall was covered in pieces of paper with blue tack sticking them all along his wall where he was developing the story, like Walt Disney with a storyboard. And so my big tip is forget the computer to start with, forget the PowerPoint to begin with, simply get the story structure right, like a storyboard first. And then the last thing to do is think which visuals would enhance this. Whereas often people start with the computer and end up with 65 slides, most of which you may not need. Obviously, slides are good. to make get a storyboard.
Yeah, otherwise you are trying to fit your idea into the format or the design, and a lot of your time is going into that,
yeah.
Which is better spent in a more creatively productive space.
Yeah, so if you write ideas on bits of paper or post-it notes, you can move them around.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's move to the section on practice.
Yes.
My thought is that not enough is done there. I mean, we have heard of people like Steve Jobs practicing for days before a presentation.
Yes.
And then in an everyday scenario, people potentially don't practice as much. I mean, they may be planning a lot and doing whatever we are expecting them to do. So what is your thought? Is it the lack of audience that you don't have? Is it the problem that you don't want to really present in front of familiar people and get feedback from them? What stops us from practicing enough?
I'm not sure about that. I think sometimes people feel, I'm guessing that people may feel they haven't got time, that it would take too long. But my tip would be that even a short practice is fantastic, and you may not need to practice all of it. It's like playing a piece of music. If ever anybody's learned an instrument, they'll know that there are certain parts of a tune that they know much better than others. So the bit you need to practice more is the bit that you don't know as well. And the other thing I would say is that practice can be quite quick. So, for example, if you've got a smartphone, which everyone has, one of the things that you can do is to simply have a run at saying what you're going to say. Get your bullet points down, not write the whole thing as a script, but just some bullet points, and then say to yourself, right, okay, I know I'm going to give this talk. I've got 10 minutes I've been given. Let me just speak now, look at these bullet points and speak naturally. Not only will you be practicing, you'll actually be writing some of what you're going to say, because when you press the record button, the playback button, and play it back, you will have come out with things where you've surprised yourself and thought, oh, that's a good thing to say. It will have just come out of your mouth. And then you can play it back. You could be in the car, you could play it back, you could be sitting, waiting for something. And that's a way of getting to learn it as well. For a much more serious talk, you could actually practice it. I practiced for serious talk in front of a group, you know, for the big talks. I might practice in front of one or two people.
Do you see that it is a lack of audience to practice? Is that a problem? That, look, I want to practice, but I don't have enough people to look at that and give me feedback.
Okay.
But is that a challenge that people?
Yeah. Well, I think it is, because people haven't got a ready-made audience just there, ready, waiting for you to practice. But it depends what your purpose of the practice is. So, for example, you might, before one of my TEDx talks, you know, I actually invited a group to come and listen to me do it, provided some drinks and some food for them as an incentive, and told them in advance that I wanted feedback. You know, this was a long time before I did the talk, but that was for a really serious situation. You could get one person to just listen to you do a bit of it, a colleague. Say, would you mind if I just ran this past you? You don't have to do the entire thing. So it depends what you want it for. For me, if I'm preparing a serious talk, I might just want to have a little practice and have it recorded just to see if I can fit it in the time, see if I can remember the points, get it into my head. Doing it on my own is perfectly all right for that. So depending what is your objective of practicing, is it to find people critiquing you? Is it to build up your confidence in front of an audience if you're not totally confident? And using different types of practice for different purposes.
Right. Let's talk about the performance piece, because I think that's finally the key bit, right? So if you can plan, you can practice, but your performance finally is the most important part of this.
Yes.
What are the key points that one should keep in mind when they're actually on stage delivering their presentation?
Okay, so A couple of things to think about. One of the main things, typically people go too fast. Okay. I'm generalizing, but many people will go too quickly. So therefore, when we're speaking with an audience, we can afford to slow up, sound the beginnings and endings of our words better, like I'm doing now, because people at the back of a room, this will be fine for them. When you are speaking, you know the topic very well. They may not. So they need time to digest it. However, if you keep speaking at the same speed, it becomes a bit tedious. So really, we want to slow. Generally, slower is better, but slow down for emphasis, to land key points, and speed up a bit for excitement. So it's like a piece of music. If it goes up and down, it's more interesting. But always stop and slow down to land key points. But some top tips, avoid moving around too much. So if you sway about, it's much more difficult for people to listen. If you're wobbling from side to side. So my tip would be, there were three simple tips, would be stand still. Have your feet about hip width apart, with the toes pointing out slightly, and stay still. Stand upright so that you can breathe and you can practice diaphragm breathing where your tummy is coming out. Big deep breath. So stand upright. Use your hands to gesture. There's evidence that when you're gesturing with your hands, people can follow you better. Also, there's evidence that when you move your hands, you find it easier to marshal your thoughts. So stand still, move your hands, and make eye contact with the audience. So if you've got a small group of 5 or 6 or 10 people, you can look at them individually. If you've got a bigger group, you can look at sections of the auditorium. So generally stay still. I'm not saying never move, but generally you'll have a lot more authority and credibility if you stay still, use your hands to gesture, and use eye contact with the audience.
Wonderful. So this also sort of ties back with the preparation where you talk of varying the rhythm, right?
Yes.
So it sort of ties back to that bit that you do not do it in one stretch, one monotone, and so on and so forth. But that's what we tend to do. I think yes. we are in the rush to get over with. And that's the kind of psychology people have, that now that I've started, I need to flawlessly execute. So
yes.
The faster I finish, the better. Without really pausing and stopping, and I mean, I'm just saying that I know I'm generalizing too, but I'm seeing I hear this many times from people, and I see this as well in the hundreds of conferences that one goes to and looks at presentations. So you see the difference in yes. terms of the pace and rhythm and so on. Now, although in the tech, your opinion on this. I think Steve Jobs started this walking across the stage while presenting bit, you know, and that has become sort of an accepted norm in the tech conferences primarily.
Yeah.
That people do not stand still; they actually move about the stage and sort of deliver in a contemplative mode. So it is sort of contrary to what you are suggesting that one should do. I don't know the efficacy of the walking, whether that really works or not. I mean, it is possibly giving the speaker maybe time to think. I don't know why it is done that way. But I do see a lot of people walking around. But I hear you. That may be distracting. People may not be paying attention to the person. They may be reading the slide for all we know.
Now, I was going to say my tip would be move with a purpose. Move, if you're going to move for a purpose. What the audience doesn't like is if you're just wobbling about from side to side, aimlessly strolling about, you know. But if you move with a purpose, comedians move with a purpose on the stage when they're acting something out. But we're not comedians. In most business contexts, when you stand still, it's not to say never move, but if you're predominantly, you're rooted, you feel more confident when you're upright. People find it more easy to follow you. Then as you move your hands, they'll follow your hands. But it's not to say you couldn't be more informal sometimes, but predominantly my recommendation is to stay still most of the time.
I think that makes complete sense. I mean, I was just sort of wanting your view on what I see.
Well, some people move around a lot when they speak, and people say, I can name you someone who moves a lot and they're very entertaining and very good. And that's fine. And that's because they've got a lot of other skills as well. And sometimes when we move, when we tell a story, it makes it really visual. We can ham it up a bit, act it up, and that's great. So, but the problem I've got with teaching that is if I allow people who are learning presentation skills to move too much, they just end up walking all over the place and it doesn't work. So it's the kind of exception, really, with a purpose.
I agree with you completely. I have no disagreement at all. Talk a little bit about the slides, because that's what typically people are using it. I know there are other tools like Prezi and all, which makes it a little more interesting visually. But people, I think PowerPoint or a Google slide is still the standard go-to artifact that a speaker uses, unless some exceptional one doesn't use any tool at all. It's just the oratory, which is rare, right?
Yes.
So what are your thoughts about the kind of visuals or kind of slides one should be making?
Okay. So typically, I would say design the slides last. Okay. Mm. So don't fall into the trap of filling the slide sorter with all bullet points and thinking that's my presentation, because you don't need a slide for everything you're going to say. And the reason is because you're there to say it. Okay. So now you might say, well, actually, the client needs a copy of all the slides with all the detail. But my tip would be you might want to give them some extra slides with all the extra words on, but you don't need all of the words while you're speaking. Make the slides mainly visual, so predominantly pictures. So a graph, a table, a photograph, a bit of video, something like that. Occasionally you want some bullet points, but also don't clutter the slides. Keep them as simple as you can. And if you've got a more complex slide, you could guide people around it. So visual is best. People really remember pictures more than words. There's a great book called Presentation Zen by Gar Reynolds, and he talks about he gives a slide that somebody did where they wanted people to remember about blogs, and their point was blogs are like sharks; they need to keep moving or they die. And one slide had a lot of information saying that, bullet points, but the revised slide simply had a dramatic photograph of a shark, and it just said, you know, you need to keep it moving, and there was the shark. So we remembered the picture of the shark. So visual is good. The other thing I'd say is that don't be led by the slides. Often people make the slide the main act and they relegate themselves to simply the narrator of the slides. Instead, you are the presentation. Stand upright, look at the audience, land your points when you're looking at them, get the slide off when you want to land your key point that's a serious point, and look directly at the audience. And the other tip I would give is, and you don't have to do this on every slide, but introduce the slides and get people curious. Quite often what happens is people will put the next slide up while they're still talking about the previous slide, or they will put the slide up and immediately people are reading all of it, but you want them to look at one bit of it. So much better is to get in the habit of introducing a slide before you show it. Okay, it creates some interest. So you might say something like, I'm now going to show you a graph of the results for the first quarter of 2024. I want you to see if you can notice something unusual. I wonder if you can spot it. Or then you might say, I'm going to show you now three logos of famous companies. I wonder which one you think has got the biggest turnover. Okay. Or I'm now going to show you a diagram of the football stadium. And we're talking about safety. Now, there are a lot of different parts to the stadium, but I want you to look at the part that I've marked in blue. And then people will look immediately at that part. Okay.
Right.
So anything that begins to guide people through, and the brain likes the big picture first, generally. So if you tell people more or less what's coming up, they prefer that, but get them curious and make it a little bit more two-way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty much like the format idea that if you're giving them the how, why, what, and what if, then it sort of gives them the lay of the land and you're also sort of channelizing their thoughts into those pockets.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And you can give them the sequence. You can move on. If you showed a slide about the factory or something, you can say, well, we've talked about the factory. Now we're going to move on to the marketing department. And, you know, make the links between all of the slides so they can follow where you're going.
Great. So let's end in a high. That's what you suggest.
Yes.
Right? So what would be, of course, these are all general suggestions. We are not talking about a specific topic or a specific situation, but trying to end it in a high, how do you see that playing out most of the times? I mean, you just mentioned about a pharmaceutical company, a presentation that is being done. So what is high in that context is very different from your TED Talk.
Absolutely, yes. But some general rules for ending on a high, I think, are at the end of a talk, even if you've had questions, I would still say something at the end to end on a high. So don't finish by, when the question's finished, don't say, are there any more questions? No, thank you very much. Because the last question might have been an awkward one that you got stuck on. You know, you don't want them to remember that.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the end, there are three things I would suggest you do. Number one, summarize your key message. This is pretty obvious, really. Most people would do that. So what is the key message? That's one. Secondly, what is the call to action? What do you want them to do? Okay. And the easier you can make the first step in the call to action, the better. Okay. And the third one is, describe how things will be different in the future when they take that action. Okay. So I'll give you an example. It might be that you were talking to people in a meeting about health and safety policy. So you say, okay, so let me highlight the key important point about this new safety procedure. Okay. It's A, B, and C. What I'd like you to do is take a copy of this that I've given you today. And on Monday, I'd like you to share that with your teams. If you all do that, by next week, 100 people will know about this. And going forward, if we put this into practice, we're going to have a safer factory going forward. And when we look at the report in the next 3 months, we shouldn't have any accidents in our premises. Okay. So you appeal to people to take a small action and show them how the big result will come from it. And you can apply that to anything.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. Great. Graham, would you like to talk about something I didn't touch upon? I know I was doing a very random walk through the book. I was not very methodical about it, simply because I picked up things that were interesting for me.
Yeah. What I'd like to say is to encourage the listeners, really also, to be yourself. This isn't about, sometimes we think of a presentation as something fancy, you know. Chris Anderson said, there's no one way, the head of TED, there's no one way to do a presentation. Go with your strengths. Just talk to people. You might help you not to think of it as a presentation, but just a conversation. Talk to people. People will like you being yourself. And people are very forgiving when you really want to help them. So it doesn't have to be perfect. People know that you're probably not doing a presentation every week. You're not the CEO of the company that doing some massive talk. You may be, of course. But just be yourself and at the same time learn from others. These are all top tips, but we don't want everybody to be the same in their presenting. That would be very boring. So remember to be yourself. Remember, it doesn't have to be perfect. Remember, even someone who wins an Olympic gold medal hasn't always done the absolute perfect performance. They could tell you one or two little things they could improve. You go to a concert at a symphony hall and it sounds fantastic. But if you ask the violin player, he'd say, well, there were one or two little things we could have done better. But it was, the bar was so high because they they did what they know worked and what they've learned works.
Right.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos, and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
This was fascinating, Graham. Thank you so much for coming and bearing all the tech snafus that was going on at my end. Sorry about that. But I think we had a great session. And thank you very much for being patient and being so generous.
No, it's been my pleasure, Shubhanjan. And I really appreciate you asking me on the show. And all the best to the listeners too.
Thank you so much.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes with great conversations on breakthrough books. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.